South Florida's future and flooding. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's a new report that looks at the cities and communities around the country at greatest risk of sea level rise. Of the top 15 cities on that list, more than 10 of them are in South Florida. What does that mean for our future? Well, the federal government has a deadline today to decide the fate of thousands of Hondurans and Nicaraguans who are receiving temporary protected status. The deadlines for Haitians and Salvadorans are coming up soon as well. We'll talk with Catholic Legal Services about what they're doing to help folks whose fate could be decided today. Also, we'll meet a student from American Heritage School in Broward County who competed in a national STEM competition with her idea for making our roofs stronger in hurricane winds. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, we know coastal flooding is a big problem in South Florida. High tides, king tides, rain, and storm surge cause water to fill low-lying coastal areas. This weekend, different parts of South Florida experienced another king tide. From West Palm Beach to Hollywood, there were streets once again flooding due to the tide, even though there wasn't much rain. A recent report highlights just how serious of a threat coastal tiding is in South Florida. It's an analysis from Climate Central. That's an independent nonprofit research organization that connects scientists and the public on climate change risks. Climate Central ranked the U.S. cities most at risk for coastal flooding today and in 2050. And of the top 15 cities at risk, 12 of them are in Southeast Florida. All right, so joining me now in studio to talk about this and some other stuff dealing with flooding and tides and so forth, WLRN's Kate Stein. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right, so what did you see and hear about the king tide this weekend? I mean, I'm lucky in that in Kendall, I don't see it as much, but I know that it can affect us out there too.
Yeah, so a couple of interesting projects happened this weekend with the king tides, a couple of citizen science projects in Monroe County and in Miami-Dade, and perhaps other places as well, but the two that were on my radar, there's a king tides photo challenge and then a citizen science day. The photo challenge was in Monroe and the science day was at Vizcaya here. And basically, researchers and people from the community were out documenting what king tides looked like in South Florida, and they're working on sort of building a library. I think these are two separate projects, but basically they're building a library to compare, you know, and be able to track how king tides are potentially worsening over time as seas continue to rise.
And always a reminder too to people is that it's not just people living on the coast that are impacted.
Right.
This could be inland as well. I think with the one here in Miami-Dade County, some of that water was coming up through the manholes.
Yeah, we have problems with water coming up through the stormwater system, and that's something that the county is in the process of evaluating, you know, the way their stormwater master plan works and how they're going to prepare for rising seas with that.
All right, let's look at this Climate Central analysis. Again, looking at the 15 cities most impacted by flooding and sea level rise in the coming decades, New York City was at the top of the list, but 12? Of the cities, and the 15 are here in Southeast Florida. All right, so looking at this report, what surprised you?
So, first of all, this is the city's most vulnerable to coastal flooding today, and it's ranked by population. And New York is number one because population. But then, like, numbers 2 through 15 are kind of like a list of South Florida communities in order of population.
It was just like South Florida.
Yeah, it's like Miami, Pembroke Pines, Coral Springs, Miramar, Davie, Fort Lauderdale, Miami Beach, Hialeah. And then the study also looked at the city's most vulnerable 50 years from now, again, ranking them by population. And still New York is one, but then it goes to Hialeah and Miami and Fort Lauderdale. So that's based on climate projections that show sort of how the seas are going to rise and what areas in Southeast Florida are going to be impacted. Based on, I think they added the current sea level rise projections for 2050. They took the FEMA floodplain 100-year maps and then put those sea level rise projections on top of those and then kind of cross-referenced it with the population growth in different cities.
All right, so we every now and then we get these reports and they paint this bad news for us, this bad picture for us for the future. But real quickly, what is Climate Central?
So Climate Central is this nonprofit, independent climate research organization, basically. And what they do is they take a lot of data sets about things like sea level rise and climate change, and they put them out there in a way that's a little bit less jargony type of scientific. It's more like understandable for the general public. So like these rankings, we don't see in this report necessarily the science behind this, but they explain, you know, these are the criteria we used and these are the conclusions that we drew. And it's not in that like super scientific, hard to read for the average layperson type of format.
So what do you say to us average lay people? How should we take this report?
I mean, for me, this was really eye-opening because we talk so much about how sea level rise and coastal flooding are huge issues in South Florida, and we're kind of ground zero for that. But hearing that 12 of 15 cities in South Florida are at risk because of that, that was a number that was just crazy to me.
All right. You've done a lot of stories about, especially recently, about resilience and how it relates to Hurricane Irma and, of course, more broadly, South Florida's future. What is resilience and what are some of the connections that you've been making?
So a lot of times when people think about resilience here, they think mostly about sea level rise. And that's sea level rise. Addressing sea level rise is absolutely a part of resilience. But the broader concept of resilience is basically what are sort of the stresses on making South Florida a place that's going to be livable in a decade or 50 years or 100 years. And so that is sea level rise, but that's also things like aging infrastructure or issues with public transit or affordable housing. And there are a couple of programs in the works right now where they're looking at, where city planners and local officials are looking at, how do issues like public transit and sea level rise intersect, and what can we do to kind of prevent some of the issues that we might see down the road as a consequence of, say, you know, not having infrastructure, transportation infrastructure that's resilient against sea level rise.
All right, so you've had the chance to talk to a lot of different people, not just politicians. I've also heard from them as well. They take it seriously. They know there's a problem.
Yeah, it's a bipartisan issue here, I think.
It is. I get that sense too. But what about, because here's something that stood out to me. In a conversation I had with the former Coral Gables mayor some time ago, it was important to him, but it seemed almost like his constituents weren't as worried about it. They were complaining about trash pickup and recycling and something else. They weren't worried about flooding as much. But do you get the sense when you talk to just people, like, they get it? There's the water's coming up. It's not like it's in the future. It's happening now.
Right. It's happening now. That's a good question. One of the challenges that I've had as an environment reporter here is the fact that sea level rise happens millimeters and inches at a time. Like, it's happening right now, but it's slow. You know,
yeah, this isn't like, you know, a movie where a giant wave
right.
is
it's
coming.
Not, it's and, not a tsunami. Yeah. It's happening really slowly. And I think in sort of the day to day of, you know, municipal problems like trash pickup or like my power is out for a week after Hurricane Irma, sort of people lose sight and forget about the fact that this is kind of like an ongoing problem that we're going to have to face. And so I think, you know, people here are very aware that sea level rise is an ongoing threat, but it hasn't really sunk in yet that it is a threat that is actually happening in this moment and something that we really need to be taking steps to prepare for now.
Do you get the sense that they want to pay for it? Because the challenge with this is you have to start thinking about it now and building and preparing for that decades down the road. Do you get the sense that they want to pay for that? That people are willing to?
That's a good question. Because tomorrow, I think we're going to discuss this, but tomorrow in the city of Miami, there's the Miami Forever Bond that's on the ballot. And basically, that's asking voters to look at resilience issues, predominantly sea level rise and affordable housing and a few other cultural and parks related things as well. And I think that that vote tomorrow in the city of Miami will be a good indicator of whether people see sea level rise as enough of an imminent threat that they want to take action on now, and B, whether this plan or whether the plans that are being discussed to address sea level rise are concrete enough for voters to want to move forward with issuing this $400 million bond.
Remind us of the Miami Forever plan. What are voters going to be looking at?
Right. So this is a $400 million bond in the city of Miami. It goes $192 million of it would go towards sea level rise and flooding prevention. $100 million are for affordable housing, and then there's some money for public safety, for parks maintenance, for cultural facilities, and for a new fire station sort of in the Overtown area that goes in the public safety category.
And what do you get the sense from people that you've talked to? How are they going to go on this? Are they for it?
So I've been talking recently with several different climate action groups, like sort of social groups that kind of blend social justice and climate change issues. And what I've heard from them, so the one I'm thinking of in particular is the Miami Climate Alliance, which is sort of an umbrella group for a bunch of different climate change and climate action organizations. And their official position on this is, yes, we absolutely support this bond, but there are some caveats to that. And the caveats mostly being that they want to make sure that communities of color, lower income communities, are included in planning for sea level rise and for affordable housing and for the things that this bond seeks to address. And they're concerned that there's not enough specificity in some parts of the bond, because the money sort of is in buckets. Like, you get $192 million that'll go towards sea level rise projects. We don't know for sure what those projects will be yet. There's a list of proposed projects in that category. Same thing for affordable housing, public safety, all the other categories. And so the concern with these groups is that as plans develop within the specific buckets, some communities within Miami are going to be left behind.
And again, that is on the ballot for tomorrow for voters. Again, there are elections only in a few communities, and we'll be following those here on WLRN and keep you informed on that. I mean, overall, just again, coming back to this idea, this the Climate Central report comes out. Really, does it? I'm trying to think in terms of, should we be optimistic about our future in South Florida? I mean, I've had a lot of people in here. We talked about this, and I even remember talking to a professor of architecture at FAU about this, about the question of what's life going to be like by 2050? I may still be around, but, you know, are we rowing boats down the streets? I'm not. And he said that there may be some places where that happens, but I don't know. What do you hear? What do you think about the optimism of the future?
So I personally am cautiously optimistic about the future of Miami, and maybe I'm a little biased because I just really love it here. And by Miami, I mean all of South Florida, not to forget the other communities here that are dealing with sea level rise. But yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic, I would say, because first of all, there's so much attention being directed toward sea level rise and towards other resilient issues through the 100 Resilient Cities Program and the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact, which are basically two programs that address, again, sea level rise, affordable housing, transit issues, things like that, that are going to affect the long-term livability of communities here. There's a lot of interagency and kind of intergovernmental coordination on these projects, across municipal lines, across county lines, and also internationally. 100 Resilient Cities is an international program, and because Miami, Miami Beach, and Miami-Dade County are participating in this, they get linked to an international network of 99 other cities that are addressing, in some cases, similar resilience challenges. Like in Norfolk, Virginia, they're, you know, contending with sea level rise in the Netherlands. So we're connected into that network that way. The other reason that I'm optimistic is because this is Miami, I think, has, or South Florida has, a very grassroots appreciation of some of the resilience issues here. I was talking about, like, with the Miami Climate Alliance, with the Clio Institute, with Catalyst Miami. There are a bunch of different groups that are also looking at sea level rise as not just an issue on its own, but as an issue of, you know, affordability and the long-term livability of this place. And I think that because, in addition to the sort of top-down efforts on sea level rise and other resilience issues, there's also these really strong ground-up, bottom-up issues, that gives me a lot of hope, because I think that hopefully they're going to be, through some of these programs, there are going to be connections made between you know, the grassroots efforts and the sort of top-down efforts. And, you know, officials are going to be hearing more and more from community organizations about what the challenges are going forward as they address sea level rise and as they tackle other issues on that as well.
Well, as you said, people here, we see it, we feel it, we see the ocean coming up, we see water rising up in so many places. So people here do take it more seriously, I think, in many other places. Kate Stein is environmental reporter for WLRN. Kate, it's always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, thousands of Hondurans and Nicaraguans living in the U.S. under temporary protected status awaiting their fate, which could come today. That's coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, at some point today, the Department of Homeland Security is expected to reveal the fate of tens of thousands of Hondurans and Nicaraguans in the U.S. under temporary protected status, or TPS. It's the last day DHS can extend that status. Hundreds of thousands of people from El Salvador and Haiti with TPS are also waiting to learn whether or not they'll be able to stay. Well, last week, the State Department advised DHS that conditions in Central America and Haiti have improved enough that people can return. Many people from all those groups live here in South Florida. Some local members of Congress here are pushing for a pathway to a more permanent legal status. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has also asked Congress to extend TPS and to come up with a more permanent solution. Joining me now in studio is Anna Quiros with the Catholic Legal Services. Anna, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me today.
Real quickly, let's just remind people what TPS is. And you know, we have numerous different groups. We've talked a lot about Haitians here, but it's Hondurans, Nicaraguans, El Salvadorians. It's a lot of different groups.
That is correct. TPS is short for Temporary Protected Status, and it is a type of benefit that is, as the word says, temporary. However, there have been 10 countries that have been designated for TPS, and in some instances, some countries have had TPS status, or people who are what we call TPS holders have been in TPS status for about 20 years or even more.
Have you heard anything about today's potential announcement on the TPS status for Hondurans and Nicaraguans?
What I have seen is the articles that have been posted on Twitter and on the news, and fairly people are just being very, I would say, negative. We're expecting that TPS is going to be ended, or at least that's what the rumors say. And the reason for that, I believe, is also because of what happened to the Haitian TPS holders a few months back in May, when it was announced that TPS for them was going to be extended only for 6 months, when in general it has been usually extended for up to 18 months.
So you think, you're hearing that the overall feeling is that it's going to end?
That is the overall feeling. And it's a very sad and tragic thing to say, but that is just the overall feeling. But then again, it is a feeling. At this point in time, we do know that the Secretary of State has made some sort of recommendation that people in Central America and Haiti no longer need TPS status. And so I believe that most groups are just waiting for a formal word that at least for the Hondurans and Nicaraguans, that TPS may be ended. However, I haven't heard the official news yet. And again, just like my predecessor a few minutes ago, I'm an optimistic. I do believe that there is still some hope. We haven't heard the formal word yet. And
why,
I'm just hoping.
Why are you optimistic?
Why am I optimistic is because I feel like I have to be. I've been living in this country for many, many years, and I do believe in the American legal system. And even though, you know, it is a recommendation, there are other things that the Department of Homeland Security can look at, although the Secretary of State and the recommendation of the Secretary of State has a lot of weight. That doesn't mean, at least in my mind, that other groups are not going to be heard and that other people are making opposing recommendations to not end TPS.
Let's also remind folks, you know, what that TPS status or protection is for with Hondurans and folks from Nicaragua. Where did that come from?
Right. So for the Hondurans and Nicaraguans, it stems from natural disasters. TPS can be given to people from designated countries, such as Hondurans and Nicaraguans, in And in this specific case, it's really just through natural disasters. TPS can also be given if there's civil strife in a country. But we've seen, for example, Hurricane Mitch, and that was one of the reasons that TPS was extended to Hondurans and Nicaraguans. And also in for Haitians, the 2010 earthquake, for example, is another reason for them to have gotten TPS.
As we wait for that news, because as you said, it's expected to come today again on the TPS protection, the status for Nicaraguans and Hondurans. Again, as you said, you're optimistic, but you've been hearing from people who are not feeling as optimistic. Also, as you've said, and we've mentioned too, that some of the word that's coming from the federal government is that conditions in these countries are now much better, so people can return. What makes you think that they're wrong? Do you think they're wrong on that?
Well, if they're focusing on if they're just focusing their recommendation on that natural disaster occurred many, many years ago, I believe that they are wrong. There's so many other things that are occurring in these countries. For example, at least for Haiti, there's been other natural disasters that have come around since 2010. And as far as for Hondurans and Nicaraguans, there is turmoil in these countries. I believe that we can't just look at one major event that occurred many, many years ago, but also to look at a combination of factors and as whether or not the ending of a TPS status if TPS status is not extended for Hondurans or Nicaraguans, we're going to have a massive population leaving the United States. And what are they coming to? What kind of country conditions are they going to be coming to? Are they going to be able to be in a safe country? Are they going to be able to be protected? And in essence, I think that the recommendations or the people that are making these recommendations have to look at it as a whole, not just focusing on a natural disaster that occurred many, many years ago, but also just to really focus as to what's going on.
How many Hondurans and Nicaraguans are here under TPS protection?
Oh, okay. So for Hondurans, I actually had to write it down. About 86,000 TPS holders. And for Nicaraguans, it's a smaller group, but it's about 5,300 TPS holders.
And with Hondurans, do we see the majority of them here in Florida? Or actually, I thought I'd read that more of them are actually further north, living further north.
Right. In Florida, we see a little combination, but yes, in for Hondurans, I am also looking to see that, and I'm seeing that they're further north.
If the Department of Homeland Security doesn't make an announcement today, does that mean TPS is automatically extended?
No, they do have to make an announcement today. By law, they would have to make an announcement sometime today.
Say they go ahead and announce that TPS is over for these two groups. What's the next phase? Are people immediately told you have to leave, or are people going to be deported?
Right. Well, typically what's going to end up happening is that, let's say these people are going to, I'm hoping, be able to, and they should be able to perhaps renew their work permits one more time. They might, I would imagine that they would at least give some reasonable amount of time for people to really gather their belongings and get ready to leave.
Usually what's reasonable amount of time?
Reasonable amount of time, I want to say maybe about 6 months. You know, that would be, and that's what I'm just thinking of. That's the first period of time that it comes to my mind. But also, for example, that these people are going to end up being placed into removal proceedings. There is going to, you know, they have been, if they've been renewing TPS for a while, they have the current address on file, telephone numbers on file. And so the Department of Homeland Security is going to have that task of placing people in removal proceedings, because they do have to also see maybe there are other applications or benefits that can apply to them.
I'm talking with Anna Quiros of Catholic Legal Services, and again discussing the fact that today we are expecting from the Department of Homeland Security an announcement on the TPS status of thousands of Hondurans and Nicaraguans living here in the United States under that protection. What is Catholic Legal Services doing right now in working with these folks and these families?
Well, Catholic Legal Services is a nonprofit organization, and we've been serving the South Floridian community for a while now. What we are doing for the South Floridians or South Florida community is we have several programs, but the program that I'm directing, one in particular, is under a program called IMPACT, that's Immigration Partnership and Coalition. And what we're doing is we're going out to the communities. We're doing outreaches, and I call it like an inverted triangle, where we do know your rights presentations, where we educate the public, the immigrants, to we tell them this is what your rights are, this is what you can do now, and then further on we can either maybe give them a follow-up assessment, and in some limited cases give them direct representation.
And I want to ask you about what those rights are. I also want to talk to you about some of the stories that you've heard from people, their concerns if they are going to have to leave and go back to the countries of origins. Again, talking with Anna Quitos of Catholic Legal Services, we're going to continue this conversation on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And again, what we're talking about in this segment, we're discussing TPS protection. We've talked about this on the program many times, but what we're waiting for is today, the Department of Homeland Security is expected to announce the TPS status of thousands of people from Honduras and Nicaragua. Now, yes, there are Haitians here under TPS. There are people from El Salvador here under TPS and numerous other countries. But today specifically, we're waiting to hear the TPS status for these Hondurans and Nicaraguans. What's it going to be? Will that TPS protection be extended, or will they be told it's time for you to return to your country of origin? I'm speaking with Anna Quitos. She is with Catholic Legal Services. You know, you were talking about some of the services that you provide these folks, and you mentioned, well, you try to teach them about their rights. What are their rights?
Yes, so what we do is we go out to the community, as I had mentioned, and I just wanted to briefly mention that I do work for Catholic Legal Services, and it's been very, it's been a journey for me. And I say that word journey because we have actually Pope Francis on September 27th launched a 2-year immigration campaign, and it's called Share the Journey. And his call to action was to tell people, look, we have issues that are happening in the world right now. And one of those issues is basically immigration issues and what's been going on with the immigration climate, specifically in the United States, but for the Pope all over the world. He's saying, embrace the immigrant, come to an encounter with the immigrant. And I feel very fortunate, at least, that I'm under the program IMPACT, as I had mentioned. And so we're going out there really educating immigrants to know their rights. And some of those rights are the right to remain silent, the right to, the right to feel like they don't need to necessarily respond to somebody saying, what country are you from? I mean, they do have that right to remain silent and ask for an attorney. They have the right to refuse to sign documents.
I'd imagine that you have to talk to people and maybe even coach them up on what would happen if they face immigration officials.
Yes.
And these are the kind of things that they have to know.
Yes, that is exactly right. We just had an event this past Saturday at one of the churches in Doral, Florida. And so the population there was very interested and asked a lot of questions, which was great. What we do is we do the Know Your Rights presentations, and then we do role play. We try to get the audience very involved. We'll like ask somebody to please go to the front and really just try to come up with scenarios as to what they can do to protect themselves, not in a way to be rude, but just to really just empower them. These are people who have a lot of fear, and it's good to be able to give them some sense of calm and to remind them and hone them in that they're people first more than anything.
Yeah, we talk about some of these folks, they've been living in this country under this protected status for many, many years now, and some of them have American-born children. What happens in that scenario?
Yes. So this is one of the reasons why it's so important that we are able to go out to the community. Part of the impact program, it was created for family unity and also to protect the individual rights. But what happens is that if TPS ends, right, you have to look at what is left. So you have to also, under immigration law, sometimes you might be able to get what we call adjustment of status or be able to become a resident if you have family members that were born in the United States or if they're residents of the United States. But the idea is to let everyone know that they do have rights and that immigration is so complex that it's on an individual case basis that you can really be able to find out if they have something else to be able to stay in the United States or not.
What's the most typical question you get from people?
That's very difficult. They usually want to know, like, what would make me deportable? And the answer to that is, well, there really isn't a policy back before January of 2017 under the Obama administration. We had tiers of, like, immigrants that were, you know, priorities. And now anybody who doesn't have papers is a priority at this point in time.
And what about people who... at this stage, again, they've been here so many years, they have businesses, they have property, there's a lot at stake. What do you tell them about what could happen to those things?
Right. And those questions do come up, and people are, especially through the Dreamers or the DACA recipient holders, they have properties, as you mentioned, or they have joint bank accounts. So we are dealing with, like, probate and guardianship issues now, and whether or not they can have a power of attorney so that people could step in their place if they are deported. But those are areas of law that just go beyond immigration at this point in time. So it's a very big dilemma.
Again, what do you tell them? Because you said you're optimistic, but you know, again, this couldn't go the other way. And now you're talking about all these folks having a specific amount of time to pick up and go. What are you telling them about if that comes, if that happens, if this protection is lifted and they no longer have it? Right. And they're told it's time for you to go home, go back to your home country. What do you tell people at that point?
Right. Well, what we do tell them, or at least what I do tell them, is I tell them they have people in the community, maybe they don't have standing to say something and in a forum, but they have friends that are citizens, people that they've come into contact with that have some status in this country. They can, aside from doing demonstrations, or I would say peaceful demonstrations, they do have these community members that they've come into contact with. So I do tell them, listen, you know, have these people support you and say that things need to be fixed. Immigration law needs to be fixed as a whole. And then secondly, what we are telling people is go see an immigration attorney, not a notario, because notarios don't have the license to practice law, but because immigration is so complex, we're telling them that's where I say where I have hope. Because I've seen people to come at some of these outreaches that do have benefits, and they just haven't even been able to afford an immigration attorney or even be able to get a legal analysis. So I tell them, go see an immigration attorney. Don't wait till an announcement is made. You may be able to be a resident, and that's even much better than TPS.
What do you tell people is you have people who live, Americans, American citizens, who will say, you know this argument, they'll say to you, look, it's the law. And if you're not here legally, you didn't get here, you didn't arrive in this country legally, or if this protection status is up, that means you have to go. I mean, it's the law. And they feel, well, you know what? We have to follow the law. We all must follow the law. What do you say to those folks? What do you say? Because you also brought up the Pope earlier as well. And he's asked that we open our arms to immigrants. I had the Archbishop Thomas Wensky in here talking about that. But, you know, we are a nation of laws. So what do you say to American citizens who believe it's the law? It has to be.
Right. Well, the laws can be changed. This is what America is all about. We are a nation of immigrants. We're not what we're doing, at least under the program, we're not doing anything illegal. We're just giving people the information that they need to know so that they're not going to be as fearful. People that are more informed are going to be making better decisions and are not going to be posing additional risks to their, you know, own family. And so I would say go ahead, and I would respect their opinion, as I hope they would respect mine. We're just giving people information and letting them know what law is available to them.
Let me finish with this real quickly. Just real briefly, is what do you say to these folks? Again, this decision is expected today, and they have to, and if they have to plan to get back home, what are you telling them? How are you preparing for the for that announcement?
Well, we're actually going to be, I have a team of attorneys. We're training them for TPS renewals, for workshops. And for the people that are listening to the radio that are TPS holders, I would say go see an immigration attorney. The fight is not lost completely.
Again, Anna Quitos is with Catholic Legal Services, and we are awaiting at some point today, the Department of Homeland Security will make an announcement on the protected status, the TPS status, of thousands of Hondurans and Nicaraguans living in the United States. And of course, when that news breaks, we will tell you all about it. Anna Quitos, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next, we're going to meet a middle school student who may have come up with an idea that would save our roofs during a hurricane. You're going to want to hear this. Coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Remember your science fair project in middle school? If you were like me, you just did enough to get your grade because you knew I'm not a scientist. I knew I wasn't. But I have to admit that I was always fascinated by my classmates who had great ideas and were able to solve real-world problems. Sarah Kaufman is a student at American Heritage School in Plantation, and she recently took second place in a math competition for Broadcom Masters, excuse me. That's a national middle school STEM competition. Sarah came up with an idea that could save our roofs from strong hurricane winds, in particular, gabled roofs. That's the kind that looks like it was folded in half and set up on top of your house. Gabled roofs are exceptionally vulnerable to hurricanes. So I talked to her last week when she had some time off from school to learn a little bit more about her project.
So we live in a newer house where we didn't have to put shutters up, and it was pretty neat. It didn't hit us as much. It was only a Category 1 when it did hit us. And I feel like it was a good way to see what a hurricane is like without having to actually worry about getting hurt by it.
When did you start thinking about this idea for how to make roofs stronger?
I actually started thinking about this idea last year in sixth grade before I had any clue that we would get hit by a hurricane. So I just kind of had heard, and I know that one of the concerns about moving to Florida when he had moved here was, is a hurricane going to hit us? Is it a big deal for us? The idea came to me as I started hearing about what hurricanes can do and how prone we are to hurricanes.
Your mom is a former pilot.
Yes.
And that kind of gave you some inspiration, didn't it?
Correct.
All right. What was the idea? How did you come up with this idea? What is it exactly?
So the airfoil design was inspired by the winglet on an airplane, which is a little addition, kind of a new addition to the very end of the wing, which is supposed to reduce vortices or spiraling winds to the on the airplane. What I did is I took a design that looked a little bit like a wing, and I stood it up on the roof. The reason I stood it up is because if I had put it flat on, there wouldn't be any air to go underneath, and the design would not work. So I stood up at a 90-degree angle on the corners of the roof, and it was curved on one side and flat on the other, so that the wind that came in on one end had to get to the other end at the same time as the wind that went above and below. So since the fastest way to go from point A to point B is a straight line, the air on the top side had to go a bit faster than the bottom side, which is what keeps an airplane above. I inverted the design to try to make it go below, to try to make it stay down.
And the winglet on the airplane, what part of the airplane is that?
So on the very end of the wing, there's this little part that comes up. It's kind of a newer part, and it's devised to reduce vortices or spiraling winds that hit the airplane, just to kind of help it stay stable.
You did a test where you created your own wind tunnel, and this is fascinating. How did you make that happen?
So I based my design off a wind tunnel that I've seen, but a lot of the wind tunnels use slow winds to see how the wind curves around certain things. I needed a strong force to try to simulate an actual hurricane. So what I did is I got a leaf blower and I added a diffuser to it, put that into a 6-inch wide, 5-foot long PVC pipe, and then added a testing area, which is a, I cut out a little hole, I screwed in a base, and then added the base of the house onto that so that the base will not fall off.
And you were using birdhouses, right?
It was.
Okay.
And then there was a plexiglass window over that so that the wind wouldn't escape. I also used half-inch PVC pipes to straighten out the wind a little bit, so it would be a controlled experiment. But I didn't want to straighten the wind too much, or it would just not do any damage.
So as you're doing these tests, what happened? You had three different types of roofs that you're testing, right?
Correct.
So then take me through each one. So the first one is what, the typical roof that we have in Florida?
Right. So the control was just a gabled roof, which is two panels over a house. And that took a pretty short amount of time to fly off in the wind tunnel. So what I did is I started the leaf blower at the same time the timer was started. And then when that timer was started, I would time it to see how long it took for the roof to fly off.
And how long did it take on a typical gables roof?
It took a pretty short amount of time. I don't know the numbers by heart, but the gable roof took a really low amount of time to fly off.
Compared to the other ones.
Compared to the other ones. And that was pretty dangerous to think about that.
The second one was the barrier. And that one is, how do you describe that one?
That was the one that kind of had a wall around it. Okay. Around the whole thing. It was maybe about a quarter of an inch tall, pretty short.
And that was stronger than the gabled roof. That lasted longer.
Right. And then after that one actually came the rounded edge, which was just kind of like a pool noodle shape around the house. And then after that, the one that took the longest to fly off was my own idea, which had not been tested before, which was the airfoil.
How many times did you have to test it?
10 times each roof.
And your idea lasted longer than all the other ones?
It did. And that was pretty amazing to see that I could devise a solution to a problem.
Did you know anybody? Have you known or met anybody who's ever lost their roof in a hurricane?
Actually, no. I've seen videos of it, and they kind of scared me. So I saw, wait, that's happening to actual people. So if I can come up with an actual solution to the actual problem, I could make a difference.
How did you do in the school science fair, right? That's the competition you had at school first, not the
right.
The big one. But, yeah, how did it do?
In the school fair, I got first place, which was really awesome because I had been competing at my old school, but my old school was really small, about 100 kids. And it was a nice experience, but I really feel like I was going up against eighth graders in that science fair, and it was amazing to see that I could get first place.
Well, first of all, congratulations on
that.
And then, of course, there's this big competition that you were a part of. What was that like?
So I was pretty excited for it. I had a feeling that I wasn't going to get anything because I was going up against now freshmen, high schoolers who had been subjected to science long before I had. Their projects were a lot more complicated, but when I was there, I really enjoyed myself and I got to meet a lot of new people. I think we're all a big net of friends, and that's really amazing to be there and do that. We were subjected to challenges, and those challenges really encouraged us to think outside the box. So, for example, we had to devise a remote-controlled device that would go about 7 feet into murky water and collect a sediment sample. So what happened is we were thrown into this room, conference room, with a whiteboard and some PVC pipes, some motors, just a couple different things, and we were able to put together this contraption that functioned. It was really amazing.
Tell me how the judging is done in the big competition. How many different levels are there?
So the first judging is done when you submit the form, because there are about maybe 3,000 people who actually submitted the form, 3,000, 4,000, and then they picked 300 out of that number. So from that, more judging was done, and 30 were picked. So once you got to the competition over the top 30, you were in this science fair again, where it was maybe a couple hours with judges walking around, and it was really similar to a school fair, except you didn't have to explain the project because they already read it a couple times. After that, during the actual competition part, they judged you to see how you work together in a team. We were split up into six different teams of five people each, and they judged you to see how you work together as a team, how you implemented your previous knowledge to these tasks, and just how you acted around other people and what your... They wanted to see how you thought.
Did you get to go around and see other people's work and projects as well?
I saw a couple of other people, and their projects really amazed me. One boy actually took a look at glaciers and saw the patterns of the fractals. The person who ended up winning the top prize actually looked at what caused hurricanes, and that was amazing to implement solar rays and patches of sun into a way that hurricanes could actually be formed. One girl harnessed the wind between skyscrapers to make energy. They were really amazing projects.
How did you find out that you got second place?
So there was this awards dinner, which I ended up missing out on, but we went to this ceremony, and my name was called. It said, from Cooper City, Florida. And I knew that no one else was from Cooper City, Florida. That's just a small city somewhere in Florida that no one knows about. So when I heard my name being called, I was ecstatic. I had a grin from ear to ear. I've been hearing a bunch of other people get awards, and I thought, that's not going to be me. I mean, I tried my best, and that's all that really matters. You just try your best and be yourself because you're already there. But when I heard my name, I was just so happy.
And then part of getting second place is money that you could use to go to any kind of other science fair or
a
summer camp. And have you decided yet?
I have not. I made a friend there, and I want to go with her. But the problem is she lives somewhere else in the country, and I would have to coordinate that so far. And I have a lot going on right now with makeup work and whatnot. So I would really like to get that done soon, but I have not yet done that.
What are you going to do with this project now? What do you want to do with it?
So the ultimate goal would be to get a patent on it, because I feel like it would probably work. But I would probably have to perfect my design a little bit more, test different airfoils, and perfect my design, because there is probably still a flaw in this. And the best thing to do is fix that flaw. There's always room for improvement.
Are you thinking about next year's science fair already?
I am. I'm trying to devise a device that will send a message to a phone if someone picks up a gun, because I know a lot of kids don't know how harmful their parents' guns can be. So I'm trying to figure out a device to send an alarm to the phone.
Have you thought about what you want to study, go to college, study?
Definitely.
What do you want to become? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, she's already got a plan. Good.
So my ultimate goal would be to go to MIT on an ROTC scholarship. So I would go to the military and have the benefits of a veteran with a scholarship for college. And then from there, get a PhD, MD degree. So a PhD, MD is kind of a new program where you get both a PhD and an MD. So you end up, I want to be a robotic engineer, but if I want to switch over to a more medical-oriented career, I can do that without having to go back to college.
And again, that is Sarah Kaufman. She's a student at American Heritage School. Again, she took second place for this math award at the Broadcom Masters. That's a national middle school STEM competition. Again, her idea to make our roofs more resilient to hurricane winds. She may have solved the problem. We'll find out in time. We may find out. Congratulations to her. And I want to thank her mother, Nadine Leonard, who was here last week in the studios. And again, congratulations and best of luck to them. And that is our program. Thank you so much for tuning in to Sundial today, Monday, November 6th. Sundial is produced by Maeve McGorn and Polly Landis. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. And our technical supervisor, the man pushing all the buttons, is Jason Zapka. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. You can find them online, gobalo.com. And again, this will be up on iTunes as well. You can find us at WLRN.org. You can find us everywhere. We're on Facebook. Look up WLRN Sundial. Find us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think of the program. Again, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.